Isaiah chapter 40 this morning. Isaiah chapter 40. And we're going to do verses 12 through 17 this morning. I think as we come here to this passage, we come here with awe, humility, a sense of veneration for the creator of this world, God himself. I want to ask you a couple questions this morning. Have you ever promised something and then not had the ability to keep the promise? Maybe you promised something, you were going to do something for somebody, and then for whatever reason, something came up, and you didn't, it's not that you broke the promise per se, but you couldn't keep it. Did you promise your significant other that you would fix the toilet? Did you promise your neighbor you would help him with a project? Politicians give many promises, and they even give their word, only to not keep them once they are elected. I may promise you something. It may be sincere and with great intentions. Do you know what all these examples have in common? Promises are not always kept. The problem may be due to laziness. It may be due to forgetfulness. It may be due to a lack of knowledge or wisdom about that what you promised. It may be a lack of power. It may be a lack of time that you didn't come through on the promise. Maybe we can't control what happens as we promised, and then something comes up out of our control. Maybe we don't even have the proper tools to fix the toilet in the first place, even though we promised we would do it. Maybe the politicians are actually lying. God has foretold some promises to his people, and he will keep them. He has foretold that the people would go into captivity into Babylon at the end of chapter 39. Yet in the future, he also has said he will administer punishment that is due to his people in its full and entirety. He will end its warfare, and he will forgive her sins. But right now, it looked like none of that was happening. His glory will return to the nation. He said that in verse 5 of this chapter. God is promising that at some point and that in the future, he will care and redeem his people. He's promised it. His mouth had spoken it. The word of the Lord, based on it, based on this truth, we know the word of the Lord stands forever. He's said a lot in the first 11 verses. You know what? God has promised a lot of things in Isaiah 41 through 11. To a nation, though, that is about to go into destruction, into captivity, they will become enslaved and ensnared to idolatry in Babylon. These were truly, to those people who were about to be captured and led away to a foreign land, to a barbaric people, these are some big promises. Because it doesn't look like any of them are going to happen at the time this was written. The question on many people's minds would have been this: could God keep his word when the nation was stuck in Babylon and things didn't look very good? What we will find out is that unlike man, who promises a lot of things, right? God will keep his word. Let me tell you today about Babylon. I tell you about Babylon today because Babylon is coming on scene as a world's power at this time now in Isaiah 41 at 40. And Babylon, when the people of Israel and Judah came to the city 100 years after this chapter was written or thereabouts, would become an impressive city. The Babylonians thought their city to be impenetrable. The walls that surrounded it were 56 miles long. The width of the walls were 86 feet. The height, 300 feet. Two chariots with four horses each could ride side by side on the top of the wall. And if you doubt me, check the sources online. I'm not making up a story. I have the source here, right here, by the way. It was surrounded then also with a deep moat of water and had several hundred watchtowers along sections of the wall. 300 feet high, 86 feet thick, chariots could race. It was impenetrable, they thought. The Euphrates River ran through the city and under its walls, so it had a source of water. It was said that the city wouldn't run out of water and had a 20-year supply of food stored within its walls. And if you want to read anything else, read Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, of which we won't take the time. The people were of Judah now, back to Isaiah 40, were about to experience a terrible time of Babylonian conquest. They would destroy Jerusalem and the temple. The tortures of hunger, the pain and fatigue of travel, and the humiliation of exile, bondage, and servitude would be on the menu for the Jews. Their faith would no doubt be tested, and they would reach a breaking point. They would be given an option. If you would remember Daniel, and if you don't, we're going to start studying the book in the evenings, in the fall. You would be given an option like Daniel to become like the Babylonians and trust the false gods of the ungodly city. And even if they refused, many of the Jews would be drugged into a state of hopelessness as their knowledge and trust in God would be deeply lacking. Their years of attempting to be idol worshipers when they lived in Judah, all the while letting God have just a little part of their lives, would catch up with them in Babylon. Isaiah now, here in chapter 40, is unpacking the greatness of God with the full assumption that the people of Judah knew who God was. He had sent his prophets. It wasn't like the people of Judah didn't know God or didn't believe that God was a part of their lives, for they worshiped a little bit of him. They believed in the existence of God in Judah. Now, not the Babylonians, but in Judah, the Israelites, the people of Judah believed in the existence of Jehovah. This is not a matter of did God exist or not, like it is today in a lot of the world. For God's people had the promise of a host of things. But unlike human people, God has both the will and the ability to keep his word. The issue for many of us, even as believers today, is we don't always think that God is strong or powerful enough to actually keep his word. Oh, we say that he does, but do we live like he does? Perhaps we think that Jehovah has some kind of weakness. We would never say that, but we live like it. We place God on a similar level or just above us as humans. Here's the question. Can God really intervene in our weakness? Appropriate verses for this morning on the PowerPoint to start out, right? That we saw earlier. The Lord is near to those who are afflicted or over a broken heart. Is God truly big enough to encourage you and I in our discouragement and to teach us in our failures? Isaiah gives the answer today. In the sermon I've entitled, The Incomparable Greatness of God, let's take a look at God today. Let's take the view in and ask ourselves, do we really behold and believe in our God? Can God carry your burden? Do you ever worry? So you see what I'm saying? By the way, I'm with you. I'm rowing in the same boat with you. I say God can carry my burden, right? We all agree. We all shook our head on that one. And then we all probably inside, if not some of us admitting honestly and openly, we worry. Do we really believe in the incomparable greatness of God. Let's look today at it. Three things. God's immeasurable power. The second thing we're going to look at is God's infinite wisdom. And the third thing is God's, hold on, it's in the bottom of my notes, independent sovereignty. First of all, God's immeasurable power. Listen to this verse, in verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Who has meted out heaven with a span? Who has comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure? Who has weighed the mountains in a scale and the hills in a balance? While some of those in the original here, or in the authorized version, some of the words are a little hard to understand. Some of your newer translations nail them and get them just easy for you to understand. And rather quickly and easily, I'm going to show you that God has power beyond measure. Just over 100 years before the people went into captivity, Isaiah spoke these words to a people, listen, who actually desired to worship idols. So you know what God did to a people who believed in his existence and worshiped him off and on? You know what God did to a people who desired idols? Sent them to a land full of them. You see, some of the worst judgment I believe that God can do on a people is to allow them to do what they want to do. So in other words, God has laws. Do not kill, do not, you know, the Ten Commandments. God has laws. He's set up for humans to kind of follow. Not kind of, but they're supposed to. And they kind of do. What would God do if he just removed all those laws? You know who would, and it's been up on the video already in Sunday school. You know what would happen? The person who is the strongest is going to win, and he's going to wipe out everybody else. Whoever has the most money and strong is going to wipe out everybody else. And people are going to fight and kill each other. It's anarchy. It's going to be without laws. Anarchy. What would that be like? What happens if God removes himself from this world? You see what? The worst judgment that God can give is not the judgment directed by his hand. By the way, that's bad judgment. I mean, harsh. He did that to the Assyrians. You know what would be harsher? Is let everybody do what they want to do. And there's going to be major stealing, killing. I mean, that would be bad. You know what he did with his people who wanted idols? He said, here's your idols. Have at them. It didn't turn out very well for them. By the time the 70 years of captivity in Babylon was over, the people had strayed even further from God and his law. Isaiah, in your notes, now speaks to the people to demonstrate Jehovah's power over his creation, to show he is strong enough to deliver them back to their land, to call them back to God. Isaiah now shows them how much greater the Creator is than his creation. And verse 12 opens with a question. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? The answer is not given, by the way. You won't find the answer in that verse. But the answer to the question is so obvious, it can only be Jehovah and not the false gods of the land. And from now through chapters 41 and so on and so forth, God is going to make the point that idols are pointless. Jehovah is the creator. Jehovah has made an orderly creation. While his creation is vast and majestic and it's beautiful, nothing in creation compares to the creator of it. And Isaiah gives four examples to prove that while creation has form and quantity and quality and place, none of it compares to the incomparable maker, our great God. First of all, today, I'm going to prove to you that God is great and has immeasurable power by showing that God's greatness is seen in the first illustration. It is in the measure of the hollow of his hand. Now, friends, let me tell you today that God does not have a human body. He is not a person like you. Now, the Lord Jesus has a human body, but God the Father, God does not, the Creator does not, he is spirit. But these pictures are as if he does. Why does Isaiah do that? Because you cannot relate to spirit. So you have to relate into terms that you can understand. Friends, can you understand the hollow of a hand? Absolutely. And I'll tell you what the hollow of your hand is. It's right here. Cup your hand. That little part right there is the hollow of your hand. It's the cup of your hand. That is what he's referring to when he said, who's measured all of the water in the world in his hand? Now, literally, God isn't doing that because he's not measuring it in the hollow of his hand because he doesn't have one. The picture is God is above his creation. Now, let me ask you today, how much water can you hold in the hollow of your hand? Just try it. Let me ask you a question. Is it a gallon? No. How about a cup? Some of you might have big hands. I've got some of the smallest hands in the world for an adult. So my measurement's going to be a lot smaller than some of yours. My son's hands or fingers are bigger than mine already. Let me tell you today, I can't hold a cup of water in my hand, and I don't think any of you could either. 8 ounces? Probably not. How about a tablespoon? Okay, maybe we're getting closer. Not much! By the way, if you would like to know, go home today, come back next week and tell me. Put some water in, put it into an 8-ounce cup that has the measurements on the side, a measuring cup, and then tell me how much water. I'd like to know. So kids, get back to me on that. God is so great that the picture is given. It's an illustration. He can hold all the waters of the world, which I didn't write it down, but it's a few gallons. Nooksack River, when it flooded, was a few gallons. If you put the Pacific Ocean, the largest ocean in the world, plus the Atlantic, you know, start adding all these bodies of water up, the picture is God could hold them in the hollow of his hand. Not literally, but in a figurative illustration. Number two, by the way, that's incalculable. You can't really calculate. They try, but it's incalculable amount. How, by the way, could God even do this? Because he's the creator. Number two, God's greatness is seen in the measure of the breadth of his hand. Breadth, not breath, but breadth. That's a measure of length. It says, meted out heaven with a span. The word span is a breadth. Now, what is the span of your hand? I'll tell you it. I know you've been on the edge of your seat wanting to know the answer, and you've already got it up. It is the distance from the tip of your thumb to the tip of the little finger. Now, I've got a small hand, but I measured it. It's about 8 inches for me. Some of you, maybe 10. Okay? Perhaps a little more for some of you, but generally a span is 9 to 11 inches. Or, are you sitting down for this? Half a cubit, which a cubit is 18 inches. God, listen to me, he's marked off heavens with the span of his hand. He's measured heaven with the distance between. I know he doesn't have it, but that's the picture. Let me tell you that the nearest star to the earth, other than the sun, are you sitting down for this? 26 trillion miles away. Wow. That's just the next star. Who knows about the star out another gazillion miles beyond it? You know what God did? He measured all of that by his hand. Jerry Bridges says in his book on the fear of God that the span and hollow of God's hand, so the first two illustrations, show, quote, the immensity of God himself, who can deal with the entire universe as we might deal with the most trivial objects, unquote. In other words, what's a trivial object? I don't know, a drinking glass? We've dealt with a drinking glass already today, right? We've dealt with a fork, or a spoon, or a plate, objects we use every day. What do? Here's how we do it. We get it out of the cupboard, we use it, and we put it in the dishwasher, or we wash it by hand, and then we dry it, and we put it back in the cupboard every day. We handle them like nobody's business. Occasionally, we drop them and break them, but beyond that, that's all we do. That's the picture here. God handles the universe just like that. I'm not being irreverent here, but just trying to show you a human illustration. Number three. God's greatness is seen the measure of dust in a basket. Thirdly, he's comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure. Okay, the word measure is a measurement. It is about a third of a measure is similar to a quarter gallon. So one measure would be similar, it's not quite, to a gallon, okay? It's not quite that, but it's like that. Let me tell you, if I had a gallon jug here today, let's just pretend that it's equal to a gallon, a measure is equal to a gallon, compared to the ocean of the world, what is that? You'd laugh. It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. It's insignificant. I've tried to scoop water out with a gallon jug out of my hot tub to get new, you know, I have to change the water out every so often. Listen to me. I get tired after a few scoops. And I'm like, okay, I'll open up the thing and I'll turn on the hose and let it come out that way, even though it takes a lot longer. But I get tired of scooping, and it's what, 100, 200 gallon hot tub? God, so the size of that jug, and it says he has measured, comprehended is the idea of measuring, okay? He has measured the dust of the earth in a gallon jug. Now, I don't know about you, but there's a lot of dust in my house. And there's a lot of dust on the side of the road. And when you go to Arizona in monsoon season, there's a lot of dust flying around. And you go to the desert, there's a lot of dust. And you go everywhere, there's dust. We're sick of dust. You know what God could do? He can measure it in a picnic basket. All the dust in the world in a his picnic basket, so to speak. Fourthly, God's greatness is seen in the weight of the mountain and the hills. One of the most impressive landscapes in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Are their mountains. What is the most impressive thing in Whatcom County? It's Mount Baker. Everybody knows it. Everybody wants to see it. We've been able to see it a little more often lately, praise God. What's the, you know, these tall mountains, Kilimanjaro and Everest and K2 and all these other mountains. And we talk about Mount Shasta and Mount Rainier. I mean, we could go on and on. And then, you know, you go to Tennessee and they talk about mountains and they're just this little hill.
Amen.
God's, look at it, weighed the what in his scale. A scale is a measuring, you know, you step on the scale, that's the idea. God took Mount Baker and Mount Everest and all the mountains, and he just simply put them in a scale, he weighed them, easy peasy. He by the way, he included the hills of Tennessee. What's the last part of the verse? He measured the hills in a balance. You know what a balance is, friends? It's an old scale. You put the five, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think this is how it goes. You somehow figured out what something was 5 pounds, got that as the 5 pound measure, and then you balanced everything off of that. So if you put something in that was heavier than the 5 pounds, it would go, I think, no.
No, other way.
Other way. And reverse the other way. Anyway, you get the picture. That's how they used to do it. You know what God did? He took all the hills of Tennessee and of Washington and of the world, and he just put them in a scale and he measured them out. Easy peasy. To God, his creation is easy to measure because he's great. Through the vastness and greatness of creation, though the vastness and greatness of creation is stunning, right? When we look out, we're like, wow, we want to see Mount Baker. It's amazing today. It's stunning. It's vast. We go to the Grand Canyon. At least I hope I do someday. Some of you have been there. You stand at the edge of the South Rim and you're like, wow, and you go to Yellowstone and you go to wherever. I'd like to go on a road trip and see more of these things. I don't know when I have time, but I want to go. And I stand in awe and I get out my camera and I want to take pictures. It's stunning and majestic. Listen, none of that compares to God. When we consider the waters and the heavens and the mountains, they seem like, to us, incalculable objects. I can't measure those. I can barely measure the things I measured to get on the U-Haul this week. I don't have a measuring tape big enough to measure Mount Baker. Somebody did, but I don't. And I know they didn't get out a 10,000 foot measuring tape, because I don't think there's such a thing. Listen to me. When we consider the bodies of water and the heavenlies and the stars and the mountains, you know what? They seem like objects that cannot be calculated. But in God's hands, hear me out, they are easily measured. That's the point of this verse. Here's the best earthly illustration I could come up with this. God measuring the mountain is like your molehill compared to a Mount Baker. We can measure a molehill, can't we? We can put it in our picnic basket. I'm not telling you to put your dirt in the picnic basket, but as a measurement, That's what it is. The earth is to God. It's like a molehill. That's all. In meditating upon these pictures, we cannot help but exalt the transcendence of God. What does transcendence mean? Above everything. That's what this is saying. God is above all his creation. Even as the thoughts stagger our mind. Scientists can measure a portion of the vast universe, and they have. But in our humility, it is impossible to measure it all. Excuse me, in our humanity. But not for God. The very God who has promised to fulfill his word is the one who's enabled to encompass all of his creation and to measure it. And even though God is not named in this verse, the people of Judah would be quickly reminded that it was the God of Israel who placed all of his creation in the proper places. Here's a quote. The contemplation of these things here in this verse, the thinking about these things, should lead the mind directly to the consideration of the greatness and grandeur of the everlasting God who will come in glory to visit his people. Chapter 40, verse 5. Did you hear me? This God who's great and what we're measuring and talking about here today is going to visit his people again. And his word stands forever. Over and over, God would show himself to be mightier than the kings and gods of Babylon, as seen in the book of Daniel. I don't have time. My time's already running out today. But listen to me. Do you remember, I want to give you two illustrations in the book of Daniel, and we're going to look at these coming up, okay? Do you remember there was an image in the book of Daniel that nobody could interpret what it was? And then Daniel did, and he actually saved it. Some lives doing it because of God. He prayed and God answered. I was reading it last night just to refresh my memory, so that's why it's there. But you remember the head of gold? It was Babylon. He said, that's you, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel said. And then he talked about, you know, the body and the iron, legs of iron. And then the toes were kind of mixed, probably representing 10 leaders of Rome. Okay, so it was gold, bronze, I'm forgetting now all what these were, silver and iron, something like that, but it represented four empires, Babylon, the Medo-Persian, the Greeks, and the Romans. But there's one more. You remember what the other one was? There's one other piece that's mentioned. It's a stone. And it gives the idea of a small rock who's going to get thrown and defeat all of those. It represents the kingdom of Jesus. The kingdom of the Lord. The picture is just a little stone, at least in my reading it is. It's like this little stone is going to knock out all of this. Okay? You know what that stone represents? The everlasting kingdom. The kingdom of the great I Am, Jehovah. Who is it? The one who measures everything, right? That's the kingdom of that little stone. And the very kingdom of Babylon that took over Judah, who, remember, the walls are so tall and thick and water and food was of unending supply. They thought nobody would ever defeat us. You know what Daniel said? I'm predicting in his prophecy, this is what he says. You ain't going to last very long. And you will be defeated. And you know what the Medes and Persians did? They dammed up the river. Walked in on dry ground and attacked and defeated the people of Babylon while they were partying and drunk because they thought they never were going to be attacked and walked over them like nobody's business. And let me add, friends, that it was the Medes and the Persians and King Cyrus that let the people of Judah go back to their land. We're going to see that soon in this book. The Babylonians thought they were so great. God said, sorry, I got this all under control. God would keep his word. God will keep his word. You know what he's saying here? Be comforted. Comfort the people, saith the Lord. Second, God's infinite wisdom. verses 13 and 14, we've seen God's incalculable power. Can't even calculate all of these things. It's too hard for us. Or immeasurable power. God's infinite wisdom. Look at verse 13. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or who is his counselor that taught him? Isaiah now asks the second set of questions. And he directs the people, to the listeners, to the wisdom of God. The word directed in verse 13 is the same word meted in verse 12, and it means measure. It has the idea of measuring something. In other words, I'm going to say it this way. Here's what Isaiah was saying. Instead of using the word directed, I'm going to put measured. Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord? In other words, can you even put a measurement on God? Or let's just say you could. I'd like to know it. So we can measure certain things, right? We talked about it. But we can't seem to measure all of it in its vastness. If God is the answer to question number one, I want to know, Isaiah says, who can measure God? You think you're so smart, maybe you can come up with some good answers for the first one, and you believe it's God, but you can come up with some measurements, right? You can measure the gallons of water in the ocean. Well, they try. And the height of the mountains. You're so smart thinking that. Then let me ask you a second question. Isaiah says, who can measure all about who God is? Who has directed God, he asks, and given him counsel? Well, the answers are obvious. God cannot be measured nor taught because he's God. He already is everything that he is. He has created, so he's the creator. He is limitless. He knows everything. It's nobody taught him. God is absolute, for no one can compare to him. He is limitless. He has infinite wisdom, infinite knowledge, absolute in power. God is self-knowledgeable. He is self-wise. He is self-unlimited. Every character trait of God is inherent in God to begin with. They are what he is. God is love. What? God is love because he not only loves us, it's because he is love. It's what he is. Everything that my dad preached on last week, God's God of comfort and peace, is what God is. He is peace and demonstrates his peace and gives us peace because that's what he is. Friends, that's not what you are. Now you are, after you're a Christian, you have peace, right? You're comforted, you have hope, you can love others like God loved us. But inherently, you are not peaceful. And neither were my siblings to me when I was growing up. God created all things. God is the self-sufficient, self-existent I am the I am. It might boggle our minds. And we have to take time to think about each one of those phrases. And I have sermons on Jehovah from Exodus 3. That we can go back to and talk about what does the Jehovah name mean, the I am that I am, that he is self-existent. No one needs to help God be into existence. He was always here. No imperfect, insufficient, partially knowledgeable, or wise person. Let me repeat that. It's in your notes, but I'm going to repeat it again. No imperfect, insufficient, partially knowledgeable or wise person could even begin to give God counsel. So let's just say you think you could give God some counsel. Well, could you give me some counsel first? I got a few questions for you that I want you to answer right now. And they aren't easy questions because I haven't figured out the answers, and no, not too many others have. And I know right away you're not going to know the answers to my questions. And even if you did, they wouldn't be very sufficient. Now, I'm being a little facetious here, but the reality is you and I don't know much of anything. We know some, but we don't know everything. I want to know, how are you going to tell God, who knows everything, anything? Do you know what? Man keeps trying, don't they? You know, in some ways, they just gave up and said, there is no God. God is truly the omnipotent and omniscient creator of heaven and earth. He is unmatched. He is unrivaled. He is unparalleled. He is truly the incomparable God of everything. Jehovah is the supreme person who not just the people of Judah should trust in, but we should believe in. Our wonderful and perfect creator in perfect glory and majesty, listen to me, can protect and deliver his people. And he will. You know what Isaiah says? Comfort ye. Comfort my people, saith the Lord. Third, God's independent sovereignty. By the way, I think I skipped verse 14, but it's four questions that I was just talking about. Who instructed God? Who taught God knowledge? Who gave him wisdom? That was verse 14. I ran over this a little too fast. I apologize. In other words, who did God consult in wisdom? No one. He didn't. He is wisdom. Who did God give? Who gave God direction? He is the directions. Who teaches God the path of justice? He is justice. Who taught God knowledge? He is knowledge. Who showed God the way of understanding? He is understanding. I apologize. I got ahead of myself, and my kids do not like it when I get ahead in the notes. Thirdly, God's independent sovereignty, verses 15 through 17. He goes on, Isaiah says, to show the incomparable greatness, not only that God is unbelievably able to measure and over everything and has power, not only his infinite wisdom, no one's ever taught him anything. Thirdly, his sovereignty is independent. In other words, he's got all the power in the world. Look at verse 15, and he's going to prove it. And he uses a word, an interjecting word, again, behold the nations. Now, this is not in the scripture, but I'm going to add it, parentheses, including Babylon, and the Medes and the Persians, and the Greeks, and the Romans, and the U.S., and Russia, and all the names you want to put in, China, and every strong nation that's ever been or ever will be, you could put right in there. Behold the nations, parentheses, all of them, are a drop in the bucket, and are counted as small dust on the scales, or the balance. Behold, God takes up the islands as a very little thing. What does the word sovereign mean? In your notes, I put this definition. It means a person who has supreme power or authority. To say that God is sovereign is to say he has absolute power above all nations, people, and every facet of his creation. In other words, stunningly, God is creator, is supreme over his creation. Now, it's not really stunning, but that's what he's saying. The God who made it all, he measures it all. No one taught him, is in control of every single nation of this world. And you know what? He uses three examples for this. I'll show you those in a minute. But the only thing that hinders, and I put the word hinders in quotation mark there, kind of in that second paragraph under God's independent sovereignty, the only thing that hinders God in any way is his own character. Because he is bound to his own justice, and he's bound to his holiness, and he's bound to his truth. Rosenthal, in his paper on this chapter, says, quote, God must forever, in all of his actions, be holy, just, and true. He cannot act otherwise, unquote. So in other words, the only thing that stops God or is God himself, his character. Because his character doesn't change. Do not let people tell you God changes in his character. Now, it might appear to us that God changes his mind on certain decisions. That's another sermon for another day. But God's character never has changed. In other words, if I ask you today, has God been a God of love ever since the beginning of eternity, which we can't comprehend? So, beginning of whatever we think it is. How about the beginning of time just for our sake? And we know he's before that because he's eternal. Has God always been a God of love? Has that changed? Yes? No. God's always been a God of love? No, it hasn't changed. What about mercy? What about justice? What about holiness? What about truth? All of them. Same answers. Right down the line. Do not let these people who call themselves Christians and call themselves progressive Christians say that God has changed. And they do not understand what that means. But his character hasn't changed. In other words, what God said in the Bible is not all of a sudden different today. Oh, they say, here's what they'll say. They'll say, well, in the Old Testament, he did certain things. And in the New Testament, he did certain things. And it's different. I got a lot to say about that to them. Go ahead.
Well, in Revelation 1:8, I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty.
Perfect verse. Always been, always was, always will be. And I have a sermon on that chapter. And it's an amazing chapter, absolutely. God does deal, here's what God does do. He deals with people in different ways. But let me tell you, his saving grace and faith to believe in God has never changed. Do not let anybody tell you salvation is different from the Old and the New Testament. It's all rooted in Christ. It's all by faith. Trusting God and you're declared righteous. It was with Abraham in the Old. It is with us today. And it's all rooted in the cross. And we're going to talk more of that some year when we get to the book of Hebrews, because that will prove to us that is true. I need to finish up. But the comparison is obvious. No person with his or her fragility, failures, finiteness, and foolishness can stop Jehovah in his actions. Nor can his word be hindered from its course of action. If God is going to choose to do something, it will be accomplished. No one can stand to thwart God's purposes. Guess what? No one has to this point, and no one will. And you want to know what the supreme examples of that are? Well, I can tell you the supreme one is Jesus Christ on the cross. They thought they got him. The devil thought he had him, didn't he? And he must have been partying it up when Jesus died on that cross. But he wasn't partying on day 3 when Jesus rose from the dead. Devil finally must have thought, I got him. Couldn't get him earlier when I tempted him. I couldn't get him earlier in certain things. He always had an answer. Now he's dead. What a rude awakening the devil got when he rose from the dead. That's the supreme example, friends. Does God keep his word? So now we have to sit here while we're waiting for these promises to be fulfilled. This is hard. Because we want God to, we want to be done with this crazy world. But it's not your choice. It's not my choice. God is still waiting, and I think this is the reason why, the main reason. He's still waiting for more people to repent. Please don't forget that. He's a long-suffering God. And you and I better be grateful that he waited for us. The people of Judah must have had the powerful military of the Babylonians, since they knew they were going to be taken, and the Assyrians who tried to take them, must have been on their mind. Even as Isaiah was speaking these words of prophecy, God says, I'm going to take care of you. And they're thinking, well, the Babylonians are coming to get us. Then they go to Babylon. They reread these words of Isaiah 100 years later. And they're sitting in captivity, in slavery, in bondage. Most of them worshiping the Babylonian idols, except Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and a few others. They've given up. They have no hope. Maybe somebody refreshes them about these promises. They probably laughed. What would happen to the nation of Babylon? They must have thought. As they looked, how were they going to escape these 86-foot walls with all these military might? They wouldn't even make it very far with all their watchtowers and guards. They're stuck here, they must have thought. But Isaiah promised there's hope. I don't see any hope, they said. Do you get that way? We get that way. We look around and say, we know the promises. We see what's going on. There seems to be no hope. Let me remind you, behold, the nations are a drop in the bucket. Whatever nations are out here, including our own, are just a drop in the bucket. That's what Isaiah declares. What is a drop in the bucket? A couple ideas. I like the last one, But here's a couple ideas of what a drop in the bucket might have meant. It meant it was the last drop in the bucket. It meant one drop poured out of a full bucket. So you see the comparison? Either one drop in an empty bucket or one drop from a full bucket. But I like the last one. It may have referenced a drop that fell from a bucket as it was pulled from a well, which they had a lot in those days. So they put a bucket down into the well, they pulled out the bucket of water, and a drop fell out. You know what God said? That's what the nations are like. Compared to that full bucket of water, that little water drop that is me taking care of the nations. Number two, he says in this chapter, or in this verse, there are dust on a balance, a scale. Now, you know me, I love to go grocery shopping, and I like to get the best deals. Sometimes I don't get very good product getting that way, but that's, forget that. Have you ever seen those scales? They don't have them so much anymore, do they? But you remember in those, you know, in past years, they'd have the scale in the produce section, right? And they still probably have them, but I don't want any extra weight on my scale. And when I go to Food Pavilion and I get my, and I want to weigh my watermelon, I'm being a little facetious here. I don't want one speck of dust on that scale to add weight to my cost. Because I'm a frugal Dutch Jew that doesn't like to waste any money. And I don't want one single piece of dust. So I go to Amanda, who works in the produce manager at Food Pavilion, and I say to Amanda, could you please pick the best watermelon you like? Because I'm going to take that one. Because if I pick it, it won't wind up very good. And then I take it over here, and as I'm about to put the watermelon or whatever fruit into the scale, you know what I notice? One, not two, one piece of dust. And I go to Amanda, I say, Amanda, could you get your rag and get that dust out of there? What do you think she would say to me? Besides the fact that she'd probably laugh, because she knows me, and she knows I wouldn't have done this. But what craziness? Nobody does that. Now, if there was some extra heavy stuff in there, you would quickly take it out because you don't want the scale to add to your weight. The point is this. The nations of the world are like that one speck of dust on the balance scales. It's not that they're insignificant. It's not that they are not there. But compared to the Creator, the nations of the world, if they try to stand up against God, are just like a piece of dust that can be wiped away by God's hand. By the way, had he proven that? Has he proven that to other nations? He could just wipe them with the swipe of his hand. He did to Assyria in chapter 30, earlier in 38. Compared to God, in your notes under the small dust on a balance scale, compared to God who has no counselor, it is actually He that controls them. God controls them. Total together, if you put all the nations together, they are a little bit compared to God's power, wisdom, and sovereign ways. God no more needs the counsel of the nations than he needs counsel from man. This doesn't mean God is not concerned for the nations. Is God concerned for the nations? Well, why did he send his son? Absolutely. He's concerned for our nation as much as he's concerned for Iraq and Sudan and Brazil and Krakatoa. I don't know if that's still around. Italy, Madagascar, etc. He's concerned. But that's not what Isaiah is trying to say. Isaiah is picturing the infinite difference between the Creator and his creation. The creation needs God, but God does not need them to fulfill his purposes. Of course, God cares for the nations so much that he sent his son to die for them. And he uses the nations to fulfill his will, but they are under his sovereign control. Thirdly, in verse 15, he says, behold, again, God takes the islands as a very little thing. The word islands may refer to coastlands, which in that day, you know, around the Mediterranean Sea, okay? Some of the coastland areas that had a lot of people near the bodies of water. Water is kind of the location people go to when they don't. If you were to pick a body of water to live next to or the middle of the desert to survive, which one would you choose? That's the point here. So where all the people are, for the most part, the majority. Isaiah compares that God, here's the picture. He takes them up. It's like he picks up the people of the islands, the coastlands, all those areas. He picks them up. And they are a very little thing. You know what the definition of a very little thing is? Here's another good one. A very small, fine piece of dust. It would be no more difficult for God to move this piece of land than to move an atom. A-T-O-M. An atom. In other words, it's a vast piece of land. All God can do, he can just take it up and move it if he wanted to. That's our God. He's sovereign. So the Gentile nations like Babylon are no more important than the drop of water or speck of dust. But there's more. Look at verse 17 or 16. And Lebanon, now he takes a specific area of this coastland or this area. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn. I'll explain that. And the beasts are not sufficient for a burnt offering. Does anybody know what Lebanon was known for in the Bible? Ryan?
Cedars.
Cedarwood. You remember the temple where they got to build the temple? Solomon bought wood from
Lebanon.
Lebanon was full of brilliant boards. Beautiful, brilliant boards of wood. Tree after tree. Big ones that they hewn and cut and made the beautiful temple and overlaid it with gold. It was the Lebanon wood. You know what God says? Lebanon does not have enough wood. So that's the crowning place to get wood? It would be like saying some of the forest, the Olympic forest, isn't enough. There's not enough wood there to do whatever. Now, I haven't told you what the wood is doing, but he tells you. There's not enough wood in Lebanon to what? To burn. Well, you say, Pastor Randy, what does that mean? Not enough wood to burn. We don't want to burn the wood. Well, friends, what did they use wood to burn for?
Offerings.
Bingo. Offerings. Exact sacrifices. And, okay, it's not that they went to Lebanon to get the wood. Isaiah takes the place that has the most wood. And if you cut down every tree, you could not take all the wood of Lebanon and make it enough to appease God, to stop him from doing his sovereign will. But there's more. He goes on. He says, if we took all the animals we could find, and you took all the animals you could find, you could put them, take them all, and put them for offerings, it would be not enough to stop God from his judgment or from doing his sovereign plan. See, offerings were used to appease gods, right? They were used to try to get God to do something. You know what he's saying? You're not going to change God's mind by all the wood from Lebanon and all the animals from the area to stop God. The greatest thing you and I could do, whatever that is, to try to stop God's sovereign plan is going to go kaput. It ain't going to work. That's just a modern way of putting it in here. Lastly, look at verse 17. He then concludes, all the nations before him are as nothing. They are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. The word nothing means not. Non-existence. What Isaiah seems to say is, it is if the nations compared to God are not even in existence. Now, he's not saying they aren't, but compared to God, they aren't. They think they are. We think that we can go up against God. But if we were to battle God, it would be like we are not even here to even join the battle. That's what the comparison is. And he intensifies it. He actually says, you're less than nothing, the nations. The idea here may be difficult to grasp, but the idea is perhaps that any part of anything that the nations could offer, will not stand up against God. Notice he says they're vanity. This is the same Hebrew word in Genesis 1:2. The earth was without form. Same word, form. Without form or void before God created. The word is indicative of a vast wasteland and an uninhabitable condition of the earth before creation. In other words, all the nations that have to offer compared to God is uninhibited wasteland and desolation. Nothingness. That's what you got to offer when you go up against God. This does not mean then, let me tell you what this doesn't mean. When it says they're nothing compared to God, does not mean that they are not valuable to people or not valuable to God. That's not what he's trying to say. He's not saying the nations are not valuable. He's not saying that. He's saying compared to God's greatness, God's sovereignty. They think they can stop God. In the end, they're nothing when it comes to that. In comparison to the people of God, in comparison to the sovereign and infinite God who brought into existence, his creation is like nothing. Let me conclude with this paragraph. It's the last part in your notes. How many nations have come and gone in the history of the world? A few. Yeah, a lot is correct. And they keep coming and going, don't they? What was one of them? That's right. What's the one that's important in our book today, in our chapter? Babylon.
Yes.
Friends, I invite you to go find Babylon today. You'll find some ruins probably, but you ain't going to find a whole lot that's going to be much to stand up as an empire of the world today. In other words, I'm saying nations come and go, including Babylon. They've exalted themselves. They've tried to conquer the world only to have empire after empire be crushed by another nation. Jehovah continues as his power remains unscathed. His wisdom is flawless, and his sovereignty is preeminently displayed. It is this God who tells Isaiah then, what? I heard it. To comfort his people. His people are his chosen, and under his covenants, they are set aside for his purpose. Comfort ye, my people, saith the Lord. As we close today, you might say, that's great, that's wonderful, but I'm struggling. I got difficulties going on. We're not maybe in captivity. We're not worshiping idols, but we struggle. I struggle. I often think I'm supposed to be a shepherd of the sheep, but I'm a sheep just like you. Days are hard. We look at our culture. So what do we do when we are discouraged? After we hear this, what do you think we should do when we're discouraged? I'll tell you what. We go right back to this again. We have to keep coming back over and over, because as humans, we quickly forget the promises of God. So we come back here. That's why we come to church. We fellowship here together. You remind me. You may not know about everything. I may not know everything about you. And that's fine. I don't need to know every situation in your life. If you choose to tell me and ask me to pray, I will. But I don't know everything in your life. You don't know all the things in my life. And that's okay. But just know, we're all bearing burdens. So we come, we fellowship. We eat a meal together. I know not lately, but we try to eat meals together. We do Sundays together. This is my family time right here. And I come not just to hear the discouragements, but to encourage. How did God have a victory in your life this week? What did God do? Maybe it didn't solve the big things, the big discouragements, but what promises are there? Here's some, right here in Isaiah 40. Here's a chapter you need to mark up and down and around in your Bible to come and say, this is the mountain peak that I need to come to the next time I'm really discouraged. Now, I'm so excited about this, and I know I've gone over time, and you've listened well today. What does the last couple of verses say in this book, in this chapter? Now maybe it makes sense. Here's the problem. We like to take verses out of the Bible without knowing what they were surrounded by. So now you know what? A lot that's going on. You know about Babylon. You know about discouragement. You know about the difficulties. You know that God is being said as incomparable greatness. He will take care. He's promised him. Comfort ye, my people. Now, how does the chapter end?